This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. North Korea's state media on Monday criticized the recent termination of a pact between the United States and South Korea that capped the development of South Korea's ballistic missiles, calling it a sign of Washington's so-called shameful double-dealing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in announced the abolishment of the joint missile guidelines that had limited the country's development of ballistic missiles to a range of 800 kilometers after his first summit with U.S. President Joe Biden earlier this month. North Korea's officially KCNA news agency carried an article who described it as an international affairs critic to accuse the United States of applying a double standard as it sought to ban Pyongyang from developing ballistic missiles. U.S. President Joe Biden on Sunday said that he will press Russian President Vladimir Putin to respect human rights when the two leaders meet in June. During a speech honoring the U.S. holiday Memorial Day, Biden said, "We'll make it clear we will not stand by and let him abuse those rights." The White House said on Friday that it was planning to move ahead with the summit between the two leaders after Microsoft flagged a cyber attack on U.S. government agencies. Far-right party leader Naftali Bennett threw his crucial support on Sunday behind a unity government in Israel to unseat Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in what would be the end of the political era for him. Bennett, who leads the ultra-nationalist Yamina Party, on Sunday declared he would join with the centrist faction in a new unity government that could spell the end of Netanyahu's 12-year grip on power. This is VOA News. Egypt's foreign minister met with his Israeli counterpart on Sunday in Cairo amid efforts to build a ceasefire reached between Israel and Hamas a week ago. Egypt is working with the United States and other regional partners towards reinforcing the ceasefire broken between Israel and Palestinian militants, facilitated in part due to its longstanding relations with both sides. Three people held responsible for this month's Italy cable car disaster that killed 14 people were allowed to leave prison Sunday after a judge indicated that, for now, blame fell on just one, a service technician who intentionally disabled the car's emergency brake because it kept locking spontaneously. The judge said there wasn't sufficient evidence suggesting the owner of the cable car company, Luigi Norini, or the maintenance chief, Enrico Perocchio, knew that the technician had deactivated the brake on several occasions even before the May 23rd disaster. After evaluating the prosecutor's request for continued detention of the three, the judge determined that there was no flight risk, ordered the managers free while allowing the technician, Gabriele Tadini, to leave under house arrest. The three men remain under investigation. South Africa has extended its nightly curfew and limited the number of people at gatherings to slow the spread of the COVID-19 as positive cases surge. President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Sunday the level 2 lockdown restrictions start Monday, forcing non-essential establishments like restaurants, bars, and fitness centers to close by 2200 local time. So curfew will now start at 2300 from midnight and end at 0400. All gatherings will be limited to a maximum of 100 indoors from 250 and 250 people outdoors from 500. Where the venue is too small to accommodate these numbers, no more than 50% of the capacity of the venue may be used. Ramaphosa said, according to the country's health experts, the recent surge in new infections is due to the increasing number of social gatherings where people are not observing essential health protocols. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he wants the G7 group of rich nations to agree on a plan that would see everyone around the world vaccinated against COVID-19 by the end of 2022. In an interview with CBC News in Canada, Johnson also called for a global treaty on pandemic preparedness at next month's meeting, which will be hosted in the UK. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 31st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders call for the immediate nomination of a new civilian prime minister in Mali.
From the communique that was circulated, I think there are three main points. First is Mali is suspended from any activity within ECOWAS, and I'm sure that will be also extended to suspension from the AU.
A strike by factory workers in Lesotho continues. Gambia begins voter registration for its December 4th presidential election. Kenya's government commits to fighting gender-based violence, and thousands rally in Ethiopia in support of their government.
They feel that the current pressure by the U.S. and Europe, combined with the great of their own exemption, they feel that the pressure is too much and misrepresents the political situation in Ethiopia.
And today is World No Tobacco Day as Kenya launches a tobacco control report. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, have called for the immediate nomination of a new civilian prime minister in Mali and the formation of a new inclusive government to continue the democratic transition process. At their meeting on Sunday, May 30, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, the leaders reaffirmed their demand for the military junta in Mali to respect the democratic transition, which is expected to conclude at the end of February 2022 with a presidential election. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Khan says he fears the 18-month transitional process may not become a reality.
From the communique that was circulated, I think there are three main points. First is Mali is suspended from any activities within ECOWAS, and I'm sure that will be also extended to suspension from the AU very soon. Two, ECOWAS is no longer requiring Mali to have a president and a prime minister that are seated here. Apparently, they are accepting the fait accompli of the military by not saying in the communique not the president of Mali. Three, they're asking everybody to make an effort to help Mali to do everything to keep the 18 months of transition on track so that in the next few months, Mali will go back to a normal constitutional system.
One of the concerns I think the military has been dragging its feet, and that is the coming together with the civilian population to be included in the government. Did the leaders address that?
Well, they said in the communique that they need a new prime minister, but that was already in the first communique that they made since Ibeka resigned. So it's not something new, but maybe this time they want to make that requirement more effective in the reality. Because as you recall, the former government, yes, included some independent people, but they were not representing civil society as such. There were just individuals that were selected by the former prime minister to be part of the government. But this time they are naming civil society to be included.
A lot has happened since the last ECOWAS meeting that set the timeline for transition. Do the heads of state think that that transitional process can still work?
Well, they didn't say it in the document, but now we all realize that this transition of 18 months cannot be respected because there was a timetable for that transition with a number of things to be done. And nothing has started, and we are already in June. So I don't see the new team coming into office, trying to know what has happened, to try to look at all the files and start the process. Because drafting a constitution is not a small task. It requires a lot of effort, a lot of work. And that cannot be done in 9 months, definitely. I don't think that it would be possible. The second one, putting in place, norms, rules about good governance and other stuff. That also requires a lot of work in a country where the government only controls 20% of the territory.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. An Ethiopian analyst says Ethiopians who support their government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed see criticism by the United States and the European Union because of the Tigray crisis and the Great Renaissance Dam as an interference in Ethiopia's internal affairs. Masembet Asefa, assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law, says these grievances were manifested in a pro-government rally on Sunday. Reuters reported Sunday that more than 10,000 Ethiopians took part in an anti-U.S. rally in Addis Ababa, criticizing President Joe Biden for his policy towards Ethiopia because of the Tigray crisis. Asefa says Ethiopia should be supported instead of being shunned by the international community.
James, as you know, the Tigray crisis and the overall political situation in Ethiopia, combined with the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has created a huge pressure by the West, including the United States and Europe, on Ethiopia. And this is seen by many, probably including myself to some extent, that the pressure was a bit too much. So there are, obvious concerns by citizens to trying to show solidarity with the government. It's not only solidarity with the government, to be honest, but to say that, this is our project and, that it should not interfere in internal affairs. That kind of, I think, sentiment is growing in Ethiopia. I should also add that, Ethiopians usually are very wary of any kind of international pressure. As you know, the history of independence for a very long time, resisting colonial rule for a long time. These are, in the public consciousness, there is a level of, I think, very deep-rooted understanding of the dangers of international interference. And that's why the rally was conducted today as well.
The people who attend the rally, to what degree do they understand that the actions perhaps taken by the United States and the European Union were in reaction to what the international community sees as Ethiopian involvement, the crisis in the Tigray region?
I would say it's mixed because people are sympathetic, obviously, and concerned about the situation in Tigray, but they feel that the current pressure by the U.S. and Europe, combined with the situation, like as you mentioned, with the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, they feel that the pressure is too much and misrepresents the political situation in Ethiopia. Even the State Department, one paragraph, if you read it, one of the criticisms they forwarded against the Ethiopian government was the increasing sectarian violence. But, the sectarian structure, very deep-rooted ethnicized political, hyper-ethnicized, I would say, political structure was built before Abiy came in. So Abiy is trying to actually find a middle ground. Although you might question some of his tactics, I think he gets it right on most of his projection of political vision in Ethiopia. So that's, I think, the general sentiment that also partly, I think, people are still very concerned, I would say. But, the problem became very serious because, obviously, the TPLF attacked the northern military base, and that created a huge, I think, security problem in the region generally.
Dr. Masembet Asefa is the assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Voter registration has started in the Gambia ahead of that country's December 4th presidential election. However, hopes to have the diaspora community register have been dashed, as the chairman of the country's electoral commission says the constitution must be amended before franchise can be extended to Gambians living in the diaspora. Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Registration of voters started in earnest on Saturday. So far, no incident has been reported, according to Sambujang Jai, the chief election officer for Gambia's Independent Electoral Commission.
The process is ongoing and everything so far so good, even though during the start of the registration, like in other major massive activity, we have some hitches, the generators and the like, but they have been resolved. And most of the Gambians who turn out at the registration centers to register have received their cards.
Gambians are going to the polls on December 4, 2021 to elect a post-transition president. This followed the ushering of a new democratic dispensation in December of 2016 after decades-long dictatorial rule. There are requirements for one to be issued a voter's card. Having a birth certificate, passport, and an identity card are among the requirements. Applicants who do not have the set requirements are required to secure an attestation from a local government leader.
Attestation is part and parcel of the requirements of the law for one to be registered. And I said that we cannot operate out of the parameters of the law, out of the ambits of the law. We can only operate within the parameters, within the ambits of the law. And the law has said for one to be registered, you must be a Gambian. You must be 18 years or older, or will be 18 years by the next election date. And you must be resident or was born in a constituency.
Despite the Supreme Court's recent ruling that diaspora and Gambians should be availed the right to register and vote, the chairman of the IEC, Aliu Mamar Jai, says such registration might not be possible this year.
It's not likely because the question says there are 53 constituencies in Gambia, and you can only vote within those 53 constituencies. And the diaspora needs 5 constituencies, in which case the Electoral Act and the Constitution must be amended to factor the diaspora in with their 5 constituencies, because you can only vote within a constituency.
Senator Edwin Melvin Snow Jr. is the Chair Committee on Politics and Peace and Security for the ECOWAS Parliament. He spoke to Gambia's private television station, QTV.
Gambian, this is the first time you've been going for election without the kind of threat you had during the regime of Yahya Jammeh. This is the first time that people can freely express themselves and don't expect to be intimidated or arrested. So it's going to be a very tough election. We should not abuse the democratic space. Where your right begins is where the right of the next person ends, or where the next person ends is where you begin. So it's very important that the Gambians take advantage of the democratic space.
The registration exercise is expected to end in July. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 31st. The Lesotho government says it is doing all it can to resolve a continuing strike by factory workers, including those in the textile industry. Minister of Labor and Employment Moshe Lioma said Prime Minister Moketse Majoro has put together a parliamentary subcommittee that has been meeting with the union representing the workers. The workers say they will continue their strike until the government approves their demand for a 20% salary increase to compensate for what they say is a rise in the cost of living. They also want the pay raise to cover the 2021-2022 fiscal year and retrospectively the 2020-2021 financial year. Minister Lioma says as many as 40,000 of Lesotho's population of 2 million work in the factories, especially the textile industry, and that the strike is hurting an already struggling economy amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
The workers need the minimum wage of 2020-2021. That is why they are in the strike now. So we are trying to get through this and to get a solution. The legal section or the legal opinion saying there is no retrospective, so we are not dealing with the deals backwards, or we are not dealing with backwards deals or situation according to a law. Now the workers or the trade unions still want the minimum wage of 2020. We tried to make them aware that this one it don't work. So we have a problem now.
Are the workers refusing to go back to work?
Yes, they are refusing to go back to work. But we are still negotiating them. So now we are going to have a meeting with Prime Minister as a subcommittee from a cabinet.
So the workers want a 20% salary increase, they say, to make up for the increase in the cost of living.
Let me tell you about the increment percentage. So now for 2020-2021, they wanted 20% for textile workers, but 17% for other sectors. So now we negotiated them, so they come down for 5%. So now they want 5%. For 2020 minimum wage, which is very high when we realize that we have a COVID-19 pandemic and we have GDP is negative 6.
The garment industry is very important to Lesotho. How much impact is this strike having on that industry?
Yes, The manufacturing in Lesotho is very important because we have many people. We have about 49,000 workers who are working in the factories, especially textile. So it means now when we have a strike or when there is a strike of workers or in the factories, so it is a very huge impact because there is the economy. So our economy here in Lesotho is affected. So it means we are losing.
You mentioned there have been some violence. So who is to blame for the violence? Because I'm reading that police have used water cannons and rubber bullets. Who is responsible for the violence?
Yes, let me tell you. The trade unions should be blamed because the strike is not permitted. It's not in order. So the strikes are not permitted. So they have no permits at all. So we are supposed to blame the trade unions because they allowed there are people to get through the strikes, which is not good at all.
Minister, thank you very much for taking time to talk with me.
Thank you very much, sir.
Moshe Leoma is Lesotho's Minister of Labor and Employment. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. Kenya's government has announced a commitment of $21 million to fight gender-based violence in the country in the upcoming year. Equality Now's program officer to end sexual violence, Jean-Paul Murunga, tells Ricky Stryer that the money is desperately needed to fight what was a more than 90% increase in sexual violence in 2020.
What the statement today means, especially with regard to the financial investment, is that the government has recognized the fact that over the years, budgeting for gender-based violence programs within the government has been minimal. And because of that, he has pledged that he's progressively increasing that budget between now and his last day in office. That is in next year, 2022, is when he is exiting office after his two terms end, that he'll be making progressive investment.
It's quite a bit of money. What do you think the money should go toward, or has it been earmarked toward certain things?
So some of the things that we've identified continuously are the issues of safe shelters, where we've seen cases of women who have been raped, or girls who have been defiled, going home to live with the same people who defiled them or raped them. Because as we speak now in the whole republic, there's no government-funded safe shelter, and all the safe shelters which are there are donor-funded or charity-funded, which are sources of funds which are not stable, because these people depend on well-wishers, and especially when there are pandemics like now, definitely their ability to take in girls or take in women who have been raped will be very difficult. So that's one area. The other area we are looking at is the area of evidence collection to ensure that there is no impunity in cases of sexual violence, so that the DNA analysis of evidence can be done to pin down perpetrators, because medical evidence is a key element in proving cases of rape and cases of defilement. So this is another area where we wish this money can go to, because if you look at the budgeting for the GBV sector for the year ending this month, from last year, June to June this year, 2021, there was actually no allocation on those particular areas. For example, the area of shelters, there was nothing. The area of forensic laboratories to assist in evidence collection, there was nothing.
That was Jean-Paul Murunga, Equality Now's program officer to end sexual violence. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from Nairobi. At least 8 million people died every year around the world due to tobacco, according to the World Health Organization. As Marine Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Kenya is launching a tobacco control report findings today, Monday, as the country's smoking population rises.
Today being World No Tobacco Day, the substance kills up to half of the users, and an approximation of 1.3 million people die from secondhand smoking yearly in Kenya. 11.6% of Kenyans use tobacco products. Ann Kendagor, the acting head of Tobacco Control Division in the Ministry of Health Kenya, said that the number of Kenyans using tobacco products is on the rise.
We are so much dedicated to the theme, which is commit to quit. And one of the things that the government is trying to do is to create awareness on the availability of help for those who want to quit. We have partnered with many organizations who are offering tobacco cessation services, and we are referring all the tobacco users to some of these facilities so that they can be helped.
Over 80% of world's 1.3 billion tobacco users live in low and middle income countries. Ms. Kendagor says most respiratory diseases in Kenya as a result of tobacco products.
Tobacco smoking being a major cause of respiratory diseases in Kenya, because we have cases of pneumonia, we have cases of bronchitis affecting children mostly, and even the smokers, the adult tobacco smokers. Just like any other country, we still have a long way to help those who are using tobacco to quit so that they can ensure that their respiratory system is working well.
Despite half of tobacco users dying yearly, Ndungu Chege, a tobacco smoker from Kenya, says he has tried quitting tobacco, but he has failed.
I have tried to quit smoking tobacco, but it's difficult. Cigarette is addictive and very hard to quit. And when you are used to smoking, that is it. I can't even do my job without smoking.
All forms of tobacco are harmful, and there is no safe level of exposure to tobacco. Ms. Kendagor says Kenya is today, Monday, launching a report on tobacco control.
We will be launching a study that was carried out in Kenya in 2018. It is called an International Tobacco Control Study. This was a national survey that was looking at various indicators of tobacco control throughout the country.
The tobacco epidemic is one of the biggest public health threats the world has ever faced, killing more than 8 million people a year around the world. It is estimated that only 4% of attempts to quit tobacco will succeed. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiombo in Milwaukee, USA.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Rwanda, where Zamalek on Sunday became the first ever champions of the Basketball African League after beating U.S. Monastery 76-63 in the finals at the Kigali Arena. It's the Egyptian team's second continental trophy, having won the FIBA African Champions Cup in 1992. Walter Hodge, who joined Zamalek from U.S. Monastery, was named the 2021 Bal Hakim Olajuwon Most Valuable Player Award. Hodge, a two-time NCAA champion out of the University of Florida, recorded 12 points and 4 assists.
For me, my teammates, you know, did everything for us. Everybody showed character for our team. We was down at the beginning, but I think, you know, we did a great job. So I dedicate this trophy for my coach, my trainers, and all my team.
As you let that sink in, you're the first ever BAL MVP. What crosses your mind?
For me, it's a lot, you know. I got a lot of work, and my teammates helped me a lot. It means a lot, you know. This is the first time that this league is going to be here, and it's going to be here for a long time. I'm a specialist.
And on to soccer news. Host Senegal successfully defended their title in the Beach Soccer African Cup of Nations Senegal 2021. The Beach Teranga Lions defeated Mozambique 4-1 in Sale to win their third successive title in the Beach Soccer African after 2016 and 2018. A breeze from Raoul Mendy guided Senegal to the final win as a celebrated victory in front of their fans in the presence of CAF President Dr. Patrice Motsepe. Mozambique's second place sport and them a ticket to represent Africa at the Beach Soccer FIFA World Cup Russia 2021. Coach Abinero Usaka is the Mamba's coach.
I'm not disappointing. I'm very happy because Mozambique is the first time to participate in the African Cup. And I do the best for my country. I do the best for the competition. Today is win the best team. Senegal is the best team of this tournament. So I'm very, very happy because I lose in the best team. But next year, I'll do the best because it's playing in my country. I want to go to the final. I want to do the same. I want to do the best.
Morocco won the bronze medal after beating Uganda 5-3 in the third-place playoff earlier in the day. Now to athletics, where Ese Brume, three-time African senior champion in the long jump, broke Chioma Adjumwa's 25 years African women's long jump record in the United States. Early Sunday morning at the Chula Vista Field Festival, Southern California, 2019 World Athletics Championship long jump bronze medalist Nigeria's Ese Brume leapt to an incredible 7.17 meters in the event. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great day. And that's it for this Monday, May 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.